Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, as we look around the world and we note all of the increasing crises, nearly all of them are the result of clinging to old paradigms, regardless of the costs. Entire cities rely on groundwater that drips away towards zero with every passing hour. Money's printed with wild abandon and used to drive rates of return to zero for safe investments, even out to 3 years if you're investing in German bonds. Farmland disappears millimeter by millimeter as it blows and washes away. And all around, it seems like humans have harnessed themselves to a paradigm of being agents of dissipation and or degeneration. Well, not so fast there. More and more people are redefining what the word investment means and are seeking and finding ways to combine money and mission into regenerative enterprises. A true leader in paving the way towards sounder, local, and regenerative investing is Woody Tash, founder and chairman of the organization Slow Money, a fine individual who I think I last met when I was delivering a talk at the San Francisco Slow Money event. That must have been in 2011, I think. Woody pioneered... Yeah, it was. And so, Woody, you pioneered the integration of asset management and philanthropic purpose in the 1990s as treasurer of the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation and founding chairman of the Community Development Venture Capital Alliance. And from there, for 10 years through 2008, Woody was chairman of Investor Circle, a network of angel investors, family offices, and social purpose funds and foundations that has invested $150 million in 230 early-stage sustainability-promoting ventures and venture funds. So, Woody, it's so great to have you on the program today.
Well, whenever I hear an introduction like that, I just get a big headache and realize how old I am. But it is nice to be with you. I'll try to forget about all that.
I'm in the same boat, so we can commiserate later. So for our listeners, Woody, Slow Money, what is it and how does it work?
In most ways, it couldn't be simpler, especially now. I mean, Chris, even in 2011, when you were speaking at our third national gathering, you just think about how much in the last several years, I don't know when you're going to start counting, but the idea that there could be such a thing as money that is cheap fast. You know, when did that idea become a little more obvious to more people? So with ultra-fast trading and Michael Lewis's book Flash Boys and the flash crash and, a lot of things have been happening in the last several years that have gotten the idea out there that there might be something like such a thing as money that's too fast. So you say what slow money is, in one way to say it's the opposite of fast money, then let people kind of wonder what that might be. And it could be a number of different ways of pursuing that idea. There's another way to talk about it, which is just tied to slow food. And I think it's important to always say that. And depending on how we have this conversation today, we can get into that a little bit. But I was very inspired by a visit to Italy in 2000, meeting the slow food people over in Italy. And there, again, a short way of having that conversation, say fast food, slow food. So if you want to move in an alternative direction or to a new paradigm, like say in the food system, you move towards slow food. In the financial system, you're moving towards slow money. Now, I didn't actually answer your question yet, which I apologize for. So I'll just say, on a very concrete level, I answered you on a kind of a paradigm and philosophical, theoretical level. On a concrete level, it's just a bunch of us putting money into small food enterprises near where we live. And that's a very simple thing to say. It's not quite as simple to actually do it, but that's what we're doing.
Well, you know, one of the fabulous new investment opportunities we featured here numerous times on this show is Farmland LP. It's run by Craig Wishner and Jason Bradford. How does their model fit into the slow money framework? Does it map in at all for you?
Sure. No, sure. We know those guys well. They've participated in a few of our meetings, and they've taken one piece of the puzzle. It is all a puzzle, right? You're trying to move from, let's say, you framed it at the beginning in your own words, but I'll just say from the industrial, consumer, extractive economy towards a more regenerative, restorative economy, and it's a puzzle, and there's a bunch of pieces. So those guys have picked off a pretty interesting piece, which is, can we create a way for investors to invest in a portfolio of farmland that's going from traditional to organic farmland? And it's a really interesting thing they're doing, very much needed, because in the food system, one of the biggest, most audacious structural problem we have is that a very large percentage of the hundreds of millions of acres of farmland in this country are owned by aging farmers, and there's no legacy. It's like, where's it going to end up? Is it all going to be owned by, you know, foreign investors looking for a financial rate of return, or are they going to be owned by the next generation of, let's say, small, mid-sized organic farmers, which it would be an idealistic way to frame what we'd like to have. So they're doing a really important thing. They're a relatively new firm, and they're kind of building a model to show that you can get reasonable rates of return from doing the right thing, investing in organic farmland. So yeah, it's very much a part of it. But we're also doing a whole lot of other things, which I'm sure will not surprise you to hear me say that, beyond just the farmland piece, and processing, distribution, farm-to-table restaurants, CSAs, you know, a whole bunch of things that are needed to try to rebuild local food systems.
Rebuilding local food systems. Now, you know, a lot of the context for how we talk about this need, this urgency for a variety of things, but particularly around local food systems, is just noting the simple fact that once upon a time, farming was a net energy positive endeavor. And today it's a net energy negative endeavor, meaning we're spending 10 fossil fuel calories to produce the one that gets to the table. And a lot of that's in the transportation, and a lot of that's in the storage, and it's in the system of food rather than, you know, just the farmer growing it. Although there's a bunch there too, right? Diesel and pesticides, all that. So as we look into the future, it really seems to me that this idea of having small scale, local, and let's use this word correctly, sustainable farmed food seems to be really, really important. And I know in 2011, things were really just sort of starting to get off the ground with slow money. Tell me what's transpired since, and how many people out there are looking at it through that lens, that context of, hey, this is something we really ought to, you know, would like to do, and it's something we really ought to be doing. How many people are getting those dots connected?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So I happen to remember in my opening remarks for that event, that was our third national gathering, the one you spoke at that we're referring to. It was in October 2011. And I remember the number, $9 million. It just sticks in my head because I was basically in my opening remarks saying, okay, so $9 million has gone into a bunch of deals. I don't remember the number of deals at that point. He said, is that a lot or a little? And I was just trying to get us all to think, everyone assembled, like, so what's happening? So we've been talking about slow money for a couple of years. Investing is starting. How do we feel about the number 9 million? And the number 9 million was both a tiny amount and a large amount, depending on which way you looked at it. From an institutional standpoint, pathetically tiny amount. From the point of view of the beginning of a movement of individuals to start doing something that's very different with their money, not insignificant, not completely insignificant, depending on what frame you want to use. So thank you for asking. We've made a lot of progress in the last few years. Still relatively small in the scheme of things, but we just passed $38 billion into 350 small food enterprises, mostly in the U.S., but a little bit in France and Canada now. And we've had about 1,000 check. If people want to kind of hear how many people are doing this, about 1,000 different check writers have participated in that $38 million. That's not all the people involved in slow money, but those are all the people that actually took their checkbooks out to write checks into transactions. Some of that money is counted into farmland and Craig's thing that you just talked about, meaning a few of our folks have put money into the farmland LP thing, and that's counted in that $38 million. Mm-hmm. So I still feel kind of like where we were 3 years ago, in a sense, to say it's still a very small amount, but it's also not an insignificant amount, meaning to me what's just as important as the dollar amount and the number of deals is that we have many, many thousands of people self-organizing in communities to do slow money in various ways, whether it be networks or investment clubs, and I can tell you more about that if you want. I don't know if you want to get into those weeds or not, but it feels like we're in our fifth year, and it feels like we're still relatively early in something that is growing and will continue to build, but that's, you know, I guess that remains to be seen.
So I'm still interested in the motivation of why people are drawn to this. Let's start this way. What's the demographics of the audiences and the people who are participating? Are these boomers, young people? I see a lot of young people very interested in farming and being involved in not just farming itself, but distribution, farm to table, the whole suite.
I'm actually kind of bad at that in terms of like really understanding the demographics. I'm kind of too far into the ideas to worry about which groups are responding. That's my caveat. Uh-huh. But I'll give you just a few things. I'll say a few things that are kind of obvious. So one, let's say psychodemographic, whatever language you want to use, is baby boomers for sure. So I represent, that's me talking to my peers, basically. And you know, it's very easy to be dismissive of different groups when you label them that way. But I'll just say, to me, there's something meaningful there. There's a great, you know about the wealth, the great transfer of the $12 trillion that's going on and whatnot. So there's a significant generational thing going on with boomers who have finished raising their families, are inheriting money from their parents, and are basically scratching their heads. I'm being very polite to ourselves. They're saying, you know, we've kind of known ever since, let's say, Vietnam and Watergate and the assassinations in the 60s, that things were kind of screwed up. We kind of had this feeling that things were structurally unsound, and we had no clue what to do with it then. And now we're in our later years, and we have some resources, and we might be able to re-enter that conversation in a meaningful way. And I'm really oversimplifying a lot of things here, but I think there is some truth to that. And then there's another group at the whole other end, which is labeled oversimplistically the millennials, who, let's say, are growing up in a world where they have been questioning hierarchy from day one. It's all about networks. They're not really corporate people. They're even wondering if they should own cars. It's like a whole different series of, the gestalt is totally different on that end. And you could say that's kind of driving crowdfunding and a bunch of, let's say, democratization of finance on that end. And so I think slow money does appeal to those two groups in different ways. But I want to go back to what I said to you, beginning, Chris. I don't pretend to actually understand it that way. I really don't. I'm really trying to stay focused more on kind of the what and the why, and let the how, meaning let the different groups kind of opt in as it makes sense to them. But I think it's more important to kind of keep the direction in our minds so that as many people as possible can kind of decide in their own way to do it.
Fascinating. Yeah, I'm a parent of a millennial, and just seeing how she's navigating that whole space of she doesn't have a car, not that interested in one. Very different from the gestalt of when I was growing up. And so it's fascinating to see how rapidly those generations are shifting. So I understand, hard to really get our arms around how large and profound these shifts are. But at heart, I think they're combined in this idea that whether you're a boomer looking back on the whole thing or a millennial peering forward into it, the whole thing does kind of look structurally unsound, as you said. So I really get that. And I understand that a lot of people really want to participate in, and I know people personally who are participating in this whole farm-to-table movement and really living that dream. And, you know, there was recently an article in the New York Times, if I have the title right, it was something like, "Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers." The premise of which was that even well-run, excellently placed, artisanal, small-scale farms are not a profitable model. Did you read that?
I sure did.
Well, what's your reaction, and how does that factor into the models that you're pursuing?
Well, that's like pulling a thread that goes to a lot of different places. So, but it's good that you brought it up, because it's a very recent thing and it created quite a little kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. I'll just mention one other thing, which I don't know if we'll get into, but the New Yorker savaging Lonzo Chief a couple of weeks ago, and basically sort of calling her a charlatan for questioning GMOs the way she does and whatever. But let's stick on the one that you brought up. So there's like a bunch of corollary issues that are tied to kind of the same, let's say, I would say, debunking what we're doing because the arithmetic doesn't work, arguments. And I'm going to come back to the one we can come back to the can you make money as a small farmer in a second. But I think it's important to see what the consult is. Here's a corollary one. We can't feed the world, you know, everybody, we can't feed the world with all of these small farms. We need more production than that. You know, slow food and farm-to-table stuff is just for a few rich people and people who, let's say, drive Priuses to Whole Foods and blah, 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 dismissing it on sort of socioeconomic grounds and whatnot. Mm-hmm. All of these arguments are kind of the same argument. And the only way that I can make sense of it is to step back and look at it in a broader historical context, which is we are moving from a food system that has systematically externalized social and environmental costs for hundreds of years in the quest for cheap, shelf-stable food. And guess what? It did it. I mean, the problem we have isn't that the system doesn't work. It's like it works too well for its own good, in a sense. So we've created super cheap, super shelf-stable food, and in the process, externalized all the costs of soil erosion, depleted aquifers, you mentioned them before, toxics in the environment, chemical interactions that are never even studied, all these different things that are kind of horrible, carbon in the atmosphere, let's not forget to mention that one. Some people don't realize how much agriculture, especially large-scale industrial agriculture, produces carbon in the atmosphere. So you have a couple of hundred years of, let's say, industrial project to do that. Now we're starting to move back in another direction. The first inklings that we have don't all make sense, of course, by arithmetic. Why is that? Because if you're going to suddenly start internalizing all the costs that have been externalized for 250 years, you are going to face some pretty serious, if you want to call them market hurdles, they're going to be pretty serious market hurdles. In other words, the market doesn't know how to deal with all of this stuff. So that's a very big historical thing. And maybe I want to say one other thing on that. The elitism argument, which is, again, it's kind of tied to what that piece. It wasn't the direct angle, but it's not too far off. It's part of the same argument. It's like, hey, everybody can't afford to eat food that has the full cost of food production in it. And the answer is, yeah, you're kind of right. We all got hooked on this really cheap, subsidized, externalized cost food. So everybody's not going to wake up one day and go, you know what? I'm willing to pay twice as much for this. I'm willing to pay twice as much for that. I'm going to go down the street and pay the farmer everything he or she needs to make a full living on their farm because I know it's the right thing to do. Very few people are going to be able to do that, but some people are. And I would say we at Slow Money are part of that vanguard. We're saying, you know what? We're willing to start internalizing all those costs because we're kind of freaked out, if I can use a non-scientific term, about where things are heading over the next 25 or 50 years, and we don't want to wait for the market to try to figure it out. We want to push ahead. So that is a very big frame to put on what you just said, Chris. Pulling it back down, I'd say individual farmers, as well as others in the food system who are moving in the other direction, face all kinds of headwinds. They just do. It's the nature of the beast. Now, before you poo-poo and say you can't make money as a small farmer, I would say there are many statistics that point in the opposite direction. So if anyone wants to look at the number of farmers' markets and the number of CSAs and the fact that the USDA census, the last census, was the first time in like 75 years that the number of small farms actually went up. So there's a lot more indicators than that. I mean, organics has been growing at, let's say, depending on double digits for a long time. It's the only sector of the food system that's been growing like that. So there are plenty of indicators that consumer demand, consumers who can afford to internalize some of the costs, and the producers and distributors and whatever who are making the food for them, it is growing. It's a growing trend. To pot shot by picking out certain individuals and saying, you know, they just can't make it. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of failures. One last thing. I know I'm trying to touch on a lot. It's a very big system question that article raised and that you're raising. Mm-hmm. One other quick but important brushstroke. It's going to sound like it's a non sequitur, but it isn't. This is, if you're talking paradigms, you have to be willing to kind of look at all the pieces. Look at venture capital as like the paradigm for how you invest in early-stage high-risk ventures. And guess what? Startup Farm is an early-stage high-risk venture. It's just a low-tech, small, locally placed high-risk venture. If you got under the hood and looked at venture capital, which is supposedly the, let's say, the gold standard, if I can use a charged metaphor here for a second, the gold standard of how to invest in high-risk situations, it turns out that doesn't work very well either. And you may ask me to defend that a little bit. I will if you want me to give data. But there's just lots of carnage. Early stage things, entrepreneurship is hard on all levels. The fact that if you happen to bet on a Google, you get to make 1,000 times your money masks a lot of the carnage. And on the food side, if you get it right, you just get a nice couple of farms in the feed, but you don't get to make, you know, huge financial upside. So all of those issues are embedded. I just talked around kind of a pie there of a lot of different pieces that are all kind of raised by the specter of that article in the New York Times.
You know, it's that same specter that shows up all the time when people are analyzing alternative energy and say, yeah, but on a cents per kilowatt hour, look how expensive this is, without noting that, again, all these externalities, as you call them, the pollution that comes from fossil fuels, but the extraordinary subsidies that they receive in terms of military protection and however we want to account for that, in terms of yep. direct subsidies that they receive and tax breaks and things like that, which number in the hundreds of billions of dollars in the United States alone. And then, of course, yeah, the comparison's a little bit unfavorable because you're basically taking something where you're burning and squandering, and that cost is just baked into this thing. So it feels good and light. So when I get corn from Iowa, from a farmer who's basically burning through topsoil, it's cheap. Yeah, it is cheap. No question about it. So what you're talking about here is that we have to start valuing other things besides the pure, raw, simple economics as they've been fashioned over a period of time that's clearly delivered to us a fairly unsustainable system. How do we go about doing that, though? How do people become educated about and begin valuing other things? Like I might value, okay, my food costs a little more, that costs me a little more financially, but I know that those farmers that I'm buying it from are building the living capital over there on the farm they're growing. They're getting better soils, and their soil structure and topography and microbes are richer and better than they were when they started. And I've got this social capital I'm building with them as well. It feels good and all of that. How do you go about, is that just an education process, or how do we go about doing that? How do you do that?
Well, it's great that you went there, because what I was just thinking of while you were articulating that question, we were kind of going in the same direction. So the word culture is what was in my head, and I was thinking about relationships versus transactions. And then you kind of went to, like, how do we learn? You raised a question about learning. This is about culture. This isn't about economics. It's about, you know, what's more important, economics or culture? And guess what? In the United States, we have spent the last 100 years proving to ourselves that economics was much more important than culture. Now, that's a very incendiary statement to some people, and we can debate it if you want. But I'll just try to, like, I'll throw this out as, like, a dinner topic for a dinner table conversation. If you had a bar chart and it somehow showed in some weird metrics economy versus culture and where the bars were in 1900 in the United States and where they are in 2000 or 2014, I would say the economy has grown tremendously. The culture has been degraded. And, of course, we can debate that because culture is an intangible. It's subjective. It's about quality. It's not about transactions. It's about relationships. And to me, there's no question that we went, you know, we bet, let's say, all in on transactions, on technological innovation, on economic growth, on capitalism, you know, sort of arguing endlessly in public capitalism is the answer to capitalism. If you question it, then you must be a socialist, or you must be a member of ISIS, or you must be something. But we've gone so far in such a fundamental way, in such an extreme way, that it's like we don't want to value relationships anymore. Relationships are squishy. They're not real. Well, you just mentioned some. Relationships in the soil. And there's so many interesting facts about how little we understand about how fertility is created in the soil. But all you need to, for the point of this conversation, is to say there are billions of microorganisms and species in the soil, thousands of species and billions of microorganisms in a gram of fertile topsoil. Most of them have never even been named yet. And I always could think to myself, God, that's great. Let's not name them. Just leave them alone. Because if we try to name them, we're probably going to end up killing them. So that's relationships in the biology sense. Relationships in the cultural sense aren't that different. If you have, so when you were framing your question, I want to go back to the word culture. I thought of France, and I know it's a little goofy, France or Italy. And you think about it, here's a place where we can start talking about where economy and culture meet. Just one tiny little place, and it's around food. So I'll do it as a quiz to you, Chris. What is the typical French person, what percentage of their household budget do they spend on food?
Well, I don't know. We're 14% here in the U.S. I'm going to go a little higher. 20%?
It's less than 14. I don't know where you're getting that 14% from, but I believe it's quite a bit less than 14% in the U.S. But they're over 20%. So the numbers I usually use are 10% and 20%, but and I believe those are close enough to be representative. So then the question is, does that mean French people are stupid? Are they stupid because they pay twice as much of their household income for food? They didn't realize that they could go get the food cheaper in some other place?
No,
or is it because they value it? And
I've eaten in France, and I want to go back and do it again. It's so spectacular.
Exactly.
It's like art on my plate. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and just remember, we're not just talking about fancy, quote, French restaurants. We're talking about the typical French household buying food and preparing food at home and whatnot. So that's culture. Culture could allow us to value things differently. In the U.S., we have a very transaction-oriented culture. It's all about buy low, sell high, and that's filtered through every element of our culture, down to and including fast food, of course, which is maybe the most extreme example of how can I get food the fastest and the cheapest? How can I get calories the fastest and the cheapest? And the taste masks it by having lots of sugar and fat and salt in it. So that's what you get when you go all the way in for transactions and you sacrifice, you don't value the culture part. And that, so anyway, I'm sorry that I seem to be in a little bit of a role here, Seth, and I don't know why, but but when you were framing the question, what I was thinking about is culture. You said, how do we learn to do this? And it is it's a little daunting when you say it like that, because it seems like such a huge historical project. Like, how are we going to reintroduce culture of a different kind in the United States? But I actually think that's the test. So it's way bigger than any one financial technique, way bigger than any one asset class, way bigger even than the idea of local economies and local food. It's about relationships. It's about getting people to enjoy, I'll use a positive word, enjoy the rewards of rebuilding relationships that have been broken, by our, let's say, overzealous pursuit of transactions.
You know, this is a topic I gnaw on constantly, and at most times I'm sort of overwhelmed and daunted by the whole idea. Like, how do we refashion this whole thing? And I know a lot of people share that daunted sort of view. And on the other hand, it's actually very simple. You know, as humans, the whole idea of written language is very late in the game. The rest of the time, we were storytellers. And I'm now, the older I get, Woody, the more I believe in the power of narrative. And so we've been running with this narrative that's reinforced literally hundreds of times per day, if you're a reader at all, which says, we need an economy that grows. We need jobs that grow. We need more houses sold. We need more cars. And so we've enforced this narrative of growth in our economy. And that fundamentally, there's no requirement that our economy has to grow, but our money system has given us that, has bequeathed that little feature to us. And next thing you know, we fashioned all these sub-narratives around that. You know, what's the best way to get the economy to grow? Well, you get consumers to consume a lot. How do you do that? Well, it's best if they all live in their own houses and they all have their own cars. And that creates this sort of nuclear framework, but ultimately leads to a very fragmented, isolated sort of experience for a lot of people. And then one day those people wake up and they go, you know, this isn't actually that awesome. It's been billed as awesome, but it's not actually an awesome way to live. And so if we can get a new narrative back in there that says, listen, there's a happier, healthy, more wholesome way to live that's more in alignment with our, I'll use a term, our DNA blueprint. This is how we're built. You know, this is the hardware and the software. Best to use it this way. It feels to me like what you're doing is creating the conditions for people to start re-experiencing what I'm going to call normal human life.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I have my own, let's say, lexicon that I've developed over these last 5 years talking about slow money. One of the phrases I use is the soil of a restorative economy. And that's meant to combine like a metaphor and a reality. So if you put your hands in the soil, if you actually put your hands in the soil, if you actually garden, grow some of your own food, whatever, there's an immediate reward you get from that. And, you know, I can listen, you know, if there's a financial skeptic listening to me say that, what the hell are you talking about? That's bullshit, whatever. Well, you can say it's bullshit if you want. You might be more apt to say that if you've never done it. So if you kind of follow this a little bit, it gets to things like, okay, I had someone say this once, like, Woody, what are you spending so much time trying to garden? You're trying to, you have a movement to grow and you have a this and all your things. Your time is worth way more than that. And I say, okay, so yeah, fine. Do a traditional analysis of how much each head of broccoli that I'm growing in my garden is going to cost me based on the market value of my time. You're going to figure out that, you know, I'm spending whatever the number is, $30 in terms of my actual time and energy to have a head of broccoli instead of going to the store and buying the same thing for a few bucks. Doesn't make any sense from an economic standpoint. But guess what? And I'm going to say I don't have to finish this. It's like the MasterCard commercial that says it's priceless. You know, it's kind of silly in a certain way. But when you grow a little of your own food and you actually put your hands in the soil, you actually get a reward. You don't need an economist to measure it. You don't need some third party to certify it. And you don't need to put a price on it. It's an actual reward. And that, okay, I'm being very personal here. That's a very specific thing. One step away from that is small groups of people giving loans to organic farmers in their community. It's one step away. You know, I'll be a little more specific. We're doing it in Boulder. We have a slow money club in Boulder. We've got 27 of us. We each put $5,000 into an LLC. And we've made, I think we just made, what was it, our ninth loan. And we're up to about $95,000. Mm-hmm. So, and these are half dozen little food enterprises in the Boulder area. And it's the next best thing to putting your hands actually into the soil, because there's a reward to it. You said happier in your last question, and this is about doing something that has innate value, and from which you get rewards that are not completely monetizable. And I know that sounds really crazy to the side of our brain. I won't even say to other people. I'll say to that old side of our own brain that's been trained to measure and monetize everything and the time value of money and all that stuff. But when you actually do it, if you let yourself do it and you really kind of allow yourself to kind of feel some of the cultural implications of it, you get an immediate reward, and it's not all that squishy. It's real.
It's not at all squishy for me. I've got a huge vegetable garden, and I believe my broccoli costs a lot more than that, even based on my output. But I love.
I'm a way better gardener than you are, Chris.
On a dollar per head basis, you are. And but you know, I've grown corn this year, and for the first time in a long time, and it's just been really coming into its full sweetness here in September, and I just derive so much enjoyment from the whole process, from the whole cycle of gardening from beginning to end, and it's just fantastic. And so I think that's a great way to look at it, which is how are you gardening your community? So that is a great metaphor, that line that you put there. So I note that the great state of Vermont, it's one state to the north of me, it's about to launch Slow Money here in September of 2014. What does that mean, and what can people of Vermont look forward to from here?
Well, I'm glad you asked about that. And before I answer, just because I don't know how much longer we're going to go and I don't want to forget, I just want to say the words Louisville. I'm just going to sound like a complete non sequitur. Louisville, Kentucky, November 10th and 12th. Wendell Berry and Amy Dominey and Von Demsier. That's the next Slow Money national event. But next
I love
week
Louisville.
I'm going to be coming to Vermont. So I just wanted to get that in there. But I am going to Vermont next week for the launch of Slow Money Vermont, which is very intriguing to me since there is stuff in my book. My book is now 5+ years old. And there's actually data in the book from a study we did in northern Vermont. And this was well before the thought that something called Slow Money was going to become an organization or a network or anything else. It was just me thinking out loud and exploring and trying to kind of, you know, arrange a mosaic that maybe made some sense. And I looked at a bunch of small food enterprises in northern Vermont, and arguably Vermont is, let's say, the most advanced state in the union in terms of local food systems, small-scale agriculture, family farms, and whatnot, arguably. I mean, there'd be other states that would want to get into the debate, I guess. But so it's intriguing to me that now here we are sort of 5 years after Slow Money has actually flourished, let's say, in lots of other communities. And for the longest time, people in Vermont were kind of like, well, what do we need Slow Money for? We're already doing it. We don't need another organization here. And that's not for me to say, but now gradually a bunch of people who have been coming to some of the Slow Money national meetings or whatever said, you know what, I think there's something here that could be useful. So what I'd say how it works is simple. Slow Money is just a kind of a tent, if you want to say. It's just a way of getting people together. It's a set of ideas. We do have something called Slow Money Principles that people can go online and sign if they want. We're getting close to around 30,000 people have signed them. And it's kind of a value statement about, it starts by saying we must bring our money back down to earth. So you can see how general it is. It's very broad, but it's about many of the things we've been talking about today, about a paradigm shift from, let's say, extractive economics to, you know, putting back into the soil what we take out. And those ideas have proven useful as a way of just getting people in the room together and getting turned in the right direction. So the folks in Vermont who have been doing this for a while without the label Slow Money have decided, and I didn't have any interaction with them, actually. I just learned that they want to start a Slow Money network in Vermont. Once you start, it's just a way of getting, I think we're expecting something like 75 to 100 people in the meeting in Montpelier. I'm not sure about that, but a decent turnout. And once you get people in the room together, you start exploring how to do this deceptively simple thing, which is taking some of our money away from the abstract capital markets and putting it to work in small food enterprises near where we live. How you do that can take a variety of different forms. None of them are rocket science. You can form an investment club. That's an LLC that has certain guidelines to it. You can form a nonprofit investment club. We have one of those. It's just formed in Aspen, where the money goes in as a donation, but then stays in and creates, in a sense, a revolving loan fund if you want to think about it that way. You can just have a network. It's completely informal, meaning no legal structure at all and no capital contributions of any kind. You just bring people together over a long period of time, and entrepreneurs who need money find it from individuals who have it in various permutations and combinations. And that last one that I just said to you is the way most of the $38 million has changed hands around the United States. No formal legal structure, just groups of people meeting on a repetitive basis in the places where they live and finding things they want to do together. It's a totally non-fiduciary model. So from a paradigm standpoint, it would drive any professional investor or any quant crazy, because it's really it's kind of the opposite approach.
Mm-hmm. So Slow Money is now operating in how many states? All of them?
No, we have 20 networks that we kind of officially count. We have 40 local groups that have signed our guideline, but in about half of them, there's real investing going on. So we try to be careful how we count. So we've got 20 groups around the country. That's actually including two in Canada and one in France. So 17 okay. in the U.S., three outside the U.S., where investing is happening on a regular basis. And then we've got 13 investment clubs. I described them as these little LLCs or nonprofits where people are chipping in a little money into a pool. And then we have, let's say, dozens of other places where people are, like, let's say, like Vermont, are starting to think about how can we do this? Let's have a few meetings. Let's see if we have the traction here. And, you know, it's like anything. It doesn't take everywhere all the time. Sometimes people get a false start or two. It requires, let's say, a handful of people who really want to stick with it. And luckily, we've been finding that there's dozens of places where that happens. And I'm sure Vermont will be one because of the, if I can say the word, it's because of the cultural and economic situation of Vermont. I'm sure that the Slow Money Network will find lots of things to do and we'll have a kind of a happy time with it.
Absolutely. If you can't make Vermont work, it's not going to work at all, because that place is just already like right in the wheelhouse for you guys. And it went by a little quick. So Louisville, Kentucky, that's the national gathering this year. When is that?
So thanks for returning back to that. Appreciate it. It's November 10th to 12th. I'm very beyond pleased to be able to say Wendell Berry is kicking off the thing. We're nice. Collaborating with him and his daughter. Most people listening to this may know that, you know, will know that Wendell Berry is kind of the patron saint. He's like the Pope of, let's say, small farming and alternative ways of thinking about farming and culture and economics and whatnot. So we are just really, really gratified and excited to have his voice there. But we have Vanda Nashiva and Joel Salat and Patrick Holden from the Sustainable Food Trust in England. Amy Domini, the founder of the Domini Social Fund, so just, you know, a long time kind of leader in quote, let's say, impact investing or social investing. So we're very excited. It's in the Kentucky Center for the Performing Arts, which is just a crazily large, beautiful venue for us to meet in. And, we'd love to, let's say, have more people in the tent for obvious reasons, for all kinds of reasons. So hopefully we'll be able to attract some new folks there.
Well, anybody
who... Oh, to answer your question, about 35 states are usually represented that are at the gatherings.
Uh-huh.
They don't all have networks there, but we get people from 35 or 36 states and usually several foreign countries. And we expect that to be the same or even a little more this year.
Fantastic. And anybody who's wondering about Louisville, I went there, I think it was 2 years ago, gave a talk, and really, you know, it's a tale of two cities. It's got the obvious decaying infrastructure from the old industrial side, and then there's this really nice emergence going on of farming, small farming, craft bourbons, really, really fascinating art installations and projects that are going on there. So it has this whole vibrancy as well. I was really impressed and came away from Louisville thinking that was really just a place on the move. So great location, I think, you've picked there.
Yeah, it's almost enough to turn me into a bourbon drinker.
It could be so. So for those listeners who really want to find out more, maybe they want to participate, contribute, invest. So who can they contact or where should they look for more information here?
Well, our website is slowmoney.org. So everything is there. I guess I want to say one other word. I'm glad I thought of this before we quit. And the word is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin.
Okay. Did I leave a slightly pregnant pause after I said that?
You did.
So we are going live with something called Bitcoin sometime very soon, like within a week, I guess I'd say. And if you just think of A, the opposite of Bitcoin, and B, and by the way, I know you may love Bitcoin, Chris, so it's a whole other topic of discussion. But we I don't think we have to really get into that. All we have to say is, what's Bitcoin? It's a way for people to put money into, it's just a simple device to get people's attention in this world where people online have very quick attention spans, to say, hey, if you want to do something that's concrete, that's putting more fertility in the soil and more healthy local organic food into your community and whatnot, chip in a little money by buying a Bitcoin. It's not an actual currency. I like to think of it as an imaginary currency that has as much value or more value than that digital currency. But that's a whole other conversation. So just stay tuned. If Bitcoin sounds a little bit intriguing, I'd ask listeners to stay tuned. And soon on our website will be a page that describes what Bitcoin is. I'll maybe say one last thing that isn't as mysterious. It's a way for people to chip in and get some money to some of the entrepreneurs that will be presenting on the stage in Louisville. So we'll have about 15 or 20 food entrepreneurs from around the country doing everything from processing and distribution to grass-fed livestock production, small-scale dairy, the full gamut, you know, farmland investing, you know, the full gamut. And if people can't come but they want to chip in a little something, Decline will be a way they can do that.
Nice. Well, fantastic. So as we close up here, I'm wondering about your general views that you've been at this, 5 years? And as you look around, how does this feel to you? Does it feel like necessary but insufficient? Is it a case, you know, do you ever get the charge of too little, too late? Or you know, because I all the time run into people who just have a monstrous sense of urgency, like we really got to be doing this. We need a Manhattan Project times an Apollo Project times some whole number, like 10. You know, how do you respond to that?
That's a big imponderable. I have a couple of quick sort of off the cuff answers to it, but you know, that like I said, it's just a big imponderable. So one is, since I mentioned Wendell Berry, I'll kind of default back to him a little bit, and he's been living and writing about this for, you know, for almost 50 years now, and. He wrote a really amazing essay when he was a young man. He wrote it in 1969, and it was about a protester at the University of Kentucky who was protesting the war in Vietnam. And he actually wrote about the futility of political protest, and I don't have time to get into the whole thing, but remember, it was 1969, so times were a little bit different. And he basically said, well, we just need every individual to start changing the way they live, the way they relate to the earth, through the piece of land that they're entrusted with, and not trying to fight big abstract political battles against institutions and blah, blah, blah. So when you talk about daunting, like change, you talk about change and like going up against these huge forces that seem to be completely out of control, still going in the wrong direction, it is imponderable, it is daunting. But I do tend to go to a Wendell Berry thing, which is, can't control all that, but I can control myself. And guess what? So that's thing one. Thing two, because I have been speaking about slow money for the last 5 years, I have come to believe that there are millions of Americans. That number is made up, but it's not a goofy number. I'm not a goofy person. I'm I'm too old to be that goofy at this point. I do think there are millions. I don't know how many millions, but millions is good enough for me, who really feel in their bones what we're talking about. And if we can just give them a few more opportunities to start moving in the right direction, I believe there's some reason to believe that they will start moving in that direction. Now, lastly, I'll say, then you say, well, can it scale fast enough? Look, what's the answer? The obvious answer is almost certainly not. But I'll answer it in a more personal way. And it kind of goes back to Elliot Coleman a little bit. It's interesting. Thinking about Elliot Coleman as the iconic Maine farmer who talks about feeding the soil and not feeding the plant, and just an amazing, let's say, example of someone who's been doing the right thing for his life. I once said at a conference that I'm 99% pessimistic and 1% optimistic, but I wake up every morning in the 1%, so there's plenty to do that day. And honestly, Chris, that's my personal answer to you. That's how I feel about it. The odds of us pulling out of this trajectory we're on as a culture, like that there'll be enough movement fast enough, very low. That's how it feels to me. It doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying. And I said before, there are immediate rewards to putting your hands in the soil. I actually believe that. It's not all about pain and suffering and struggle. Mm-hmm. There's some immediate rewards for going in the other direction. Elliot, the reason I mentioned Elliot, he said to me one day after I made the 99% loss of the conference, he said, Whitman, I totally disagree with you. I'm 100% optimistic. I said, what? You are? How can that be? He said, because 40 years ago, I moved to a rocky pine forest on the coast of Maine, and I turned it into a fertile farm, where people are clamoring for my food from within 50 miles of the farm. He said, if I can do that, I know anything is possible. So that's a little too something for listeners, but I'm somewhere between, you know, I'm still sticking with my 99%, 1%, I guess. I thought maybe I'm too old to change at this point.
All right. Well, my catchphrase is always around necessary, but potentially insufficient. And here's what I'm 100% sure of. The current paradigm of the way we live is not going to continue because it can't forever. And I don't know when it's going to, you know, finally shift, but I think it's already shifting under our feet as is. And so our choices include either doing nothing about it, facing it square on, or just ignoring it completely. And I'm of the kind that says, well, you know, if this is the reality we happen to be living in, so let's deal with it. You know, when I first started all this, Woody, I was actually propelled by a desire to escape some sort of calamity that might be coming. And now that I'm fully in it, I realize I would run towards this life because my deeper, richer sense of community and my relationships, both with human and the land around me, far deeper than before. And now I understand that there's real benefits here. It's kind of like I finally discovered water. You know, all my life I've been living without water. And as soon as I discovered, I'm like, man, that is good stuff. I got to get me some more of that.
Yeah.
And I realized that, yeah, it's pretty parched in our normal existence. What is asked of us to be good consumers is a pretty sterile, you know, parched sort of a landscape for me now. And so that's really the key message that I've been sort of circling around, is this idea that, yeah, you know, it's easy, lazy money is taking your money and giving it to Wall Street and crossing your fingers and hoping it grows. It's true. Entrepreneurship and building small businesses is hard work. That's hard money. And not that you have to do all the work, but of building the actual business if you're the capitalizer of that. But you do have to do your due diligence. You've got to roll up your sleeves. You've got to understand what the business is about. And yes, that's hard work, but boy, it's rewarding and it's fulfilling work as well. So that's my
question. I guess I would just say hear to that. I have many stories I could layer onto that, but you know, clearly we're, let's say we're plowing the same ground, if you want to use the farming metaphor.
Well, DBR, and I'm really glad we're on the same field, plowing that field. So we've been talking with Woody Tash, founder and chairman of Slow Money Foundation organization. So check out slowmoney.org if you want to find out more. Woody, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, Chris, it's been great talking to you. We should stay in a little better touch.
Let's do that.